Let's start. Any questions before we start? Any questions from what we did so far? So today the goal is to finish the discussion of ferromagnetism and start superconductivity. Now, let's start with a model. So this is, it's called the Hubbard model. It has two terms. The first term is the single particle energies. This represents, say, the kinetic energy. This represents the interactions between electrons. We have assumed, so usually there will be a matrix element here. If you have four momentums, you'll write V, K1, K2, K3, K4. Using conservation of momentum, you can eliminate one momentum. So typically you'll see a notation where you have three momentums. And Fourier transform of the potential here. We've assumed that this interaction potential is constant in momentum space. And we call it U. We have taken it outside. Omega is the volume of the system. I put a factor of 2 to avoid double counting. Now, if you have an interaction potential in momentum space, which is constant, that means that in real space, the interactions are point-like. So you can think of it as an extremely short-ranged potential. And the goal is to use mean field theory so that we can simplify this Hamiltonian. Now, what we are going to assume, as we discussed yesterday, the mean field theory, it really depends on the assumptions you make for the ground state. So we assume that the mean field ground state expectation value of this operator is going to look like this. The reason is because we want to investigate the ferromagnetic state. So what this tells us is that if sigma and if you annihilate a particle in the ground state with momentum k prime and spin sigma prime, these delta functions ensure that unless you create a particle with same momentum and same spin, you would not get a finite expectation value. So that means that the spins, so this is basically the definition. So we put in this definition of the mean field parameter. We discussed yesterday that, so this seems pretty straightforward, but we discussed that this need not be true. There are examples we have seen where the ground state expectation value would not respect translational invariance or conservation of momentum. So, but for the moment, let's assume this. So we are, again, assuming that the ground state respects, conserves momentum and also conserves spin. So you cannot have a spin flip and still get a finite expectation value. Any questions so far? So we can also define from this, so this is number operator. So this is number operator, C dagger C. With these delta functions, it's number operator for momentum state that is labeled with momentum K and spin sigma. Let's define what we will call spin density. So N sigma, this is defined as 1 over volume, sum over K, N K sigma. So N up, so sigma can take two values. N up is the up spin density, and N down is the down spin density. Now, for a ferromagnetic state, we would expect these two densities to be different. If the density of up spin electrons is exactly same as density of downspin electrons, then we don't expect any magnetism in the system. So our goal is to figure out, so let's, the question we want to address is, what are the conditions, what are the constraints when n up, under what conditions? N up is not equal to n down. And that would imply a ferromagnetic state. So let's put these delta functions, these expectation values, in this Hamiltonian after we make the mean field approximation. Sorry. So we discussed mean field approximation. There are many ways. So from Wick's theorem, we know that two terms should contribute here. So when we make the mean field approximation, we get two terms, the Hartree term and the Fock term. So now what I'm going to write is just this term. Let's call this this entire term, let's call this V interaction. And I'm going to write down V interaction. And I'm going to write down both the Hartree term and the Fock term. So I've taken U outside. I have sum over K, K prime Q, sigma, sigma prime. And now I'm going to write the mean field. So this end here, this is just a number, an expectation value. So this is the term, this is the Hartree term that can be written as density operators. But we know that we will also get Fock contribution from Fock terms, which will not have same k's and same sigmas. So now these mean field parameters would give you a delta function in sigma prime. And that is going to give rise to magnetism. So the Fock term is the relevant term or is the important term for the discussion of of magnetism. So you can go through the notes and see that you get this. All right, so this is the contribution from two terms, from the Hartree term and Fock term, after we put in the mean field parameter. Now, we'll use this definition. Now see, we have assumed, so here we have the same spin already. So the delta function in K would imply that you have Q equal to zero. So you will just have CK dagger CK. Here, again, sigma is already same. Delta function in K in momentum implies q is zero. Again, you get ck prime dagger, ck prime. So these two terms become fairly easy. Now here, you would get delta function in k would imply that q is equal to k prime minus k, and the delta function in sigma will be delta sigma sigma prime. So let me write down the result, and you can quickly see yourself that that is what you would get. So this V interaction, it's going to be U divided by 2 omega multiplied by omega sum over K sigma sigma prime N sigma prime plus N sigma prime minus N sigma plus N sigma delta sigma sigma prime CK sigma dagger CK sigma. So the first two terms are coming from these two terms, and the other two terms are these two terms. So try to verify if you agree with this result. Okay, so now, because of delta function here, we only have, we basically are left with only one momentum in the problem. And we are basically, we only have now a single, basically single particle terms. Now these terms can be rewritten, and you would see that they're a bit peculiar. Let's take the first term, only the first line. Let's write it down for sigma up. Any questions about how we got that term, this expression? So now let's put sigma is up. Now this term would contribute only when sigma prime is up also. And the contribution is 2 times n up. Sigma prime is also up. This will be 2 times n up. So this term, this first line, will not contribute at all if sigma prime is up. This term will only contribute when sigma prime is down. So the contribution from first line for sigma equal to up is going to be U sum over K and up CK up dagger CK. Similarly, you'd see that for sigma down, you only have the first line will contribute. Sorry, I should have written down here. So when they're both up, it actually cancels. So I will have n down here. And so this is the important term that gives rise to magnetism. The energy for the upspin state involves the downspin density. And likewise for downspin, you have upspin density. And the origin of this term is this delta function, which comes from the Fock term. So once again, if we did not use Wick's theorem to build our intuition or to build our mean field approximation, we would not have got this term at all. So this term, to simplify, I will write this as U sum over K CK up dagger CK up. I will add it as N up plus N down minus N up. So let me just write down the mean field Hamiltonian in a notation that is even more simplified. So I will write down this mean field Hamiltonian as sum over K sigma. Some mean field energies that depend on spin as a function of K, CK sigma dagger CK sigma. And then I have contribution from these two terms. They don't involve momentum at all. So I have minus U omega by 2, sum over sigma, sigma prime, and sigma, and sigma prime, plus U omega by 2, Now, these energies, these are basically, we have this energy to start with. And now we will include these shifts. So this is plus U N up plus N down minus N sigma. So this is our mean field Hamiltonian. It only includes single particle terms. We already know the energies of it. So this Hamiltonian is relatively straightforward to write down the eigenstates. Another important thing now that is left is to discuss the self-consistency of the mean field parameter. Yes? So let's take this sigma up. So this is sigma is up. So we have 2n up. This will contribute only if sigma prime is also up. That means you get 2n up from here, and it cancels. Now let's take when sigma prime is down. This term does not contribute at all, and you get 2n down. And that's the only term that will contribute. So this delta function that comes from the Fock term, if that was not there, we would not get this. And the approximation or the assumption we made about the ground state is that it conserves spin and momentum. Any other questions? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the self-consistency equation. Now the self-consistency condition says that N sigma, which we define. So we'll take this. This is our mean field parameter. When we calculate this expectation value, in the mean field Hamiltonian, we should get back the expectation value in the ground state. So we start, so that expectation value in the mean field should be calculated with this Hamiltonian. So what that boils down to is n sigma is 1 over omega sum over k ck sigma dagger ck sigma in mean field. So the idea is we start with a mean field parameter. We plug this mean field parameter in the Hamiltonian. We'll get some Hamiltonian. We'll calculate expectation value using this Hamiltonian. This might be different from the one you put in, and you keep doing it till you get back what you put in. And at that stage, the mean field parameter is, we'll just put the label mean field. So we want to evaluate this value of the spin densities. Now, this is number operator, right? So we know, so we can calculate. So what we are interested in is to see whether there is going to be a phase transition. So we can calculate this expectation value for finite temperature. We know that this can be written as, this is basically number operator. And we know for fermions, we can replace this by Fermi Dirac distribution function. So what we are going to do is we are going to write this as 1 over omega sum over k 1 over 1 plus e to the power beta Now, all these terms that are independent of k, I've absorbed in chemical potential. Any questions so far? Now, I'm going to simplify this further, and I'm going to look at t equal to 0. At t equal to 0, this Fermi function, it basically can be replaced by a theta function. So let me write it down. At t equal to 0, let me choose one spin direction, n up. This is going to be 1 over omega, sum over k, and a theta function mu minus h bar square k square over 2m minus u n down. So basically, I have sum over k. At t equal to 0, I expect all the states below the chemical potential to be occupied, above to be empty. Chemical potential is the Fermi energy. So all I have to do, so I can write it down as this theta function. For all k values such that this quantity is below mu, you get a contribution, otherwise you don't. Any questions so far? Now, this sum can be evaluated as we can convert this sum to an integral. This is a sum in k. We'll convert it to an integral. We'll have integral d cube k divided by 2 pi cube multiplied by a volume factor that will cancel this volume factor. So we will be left with an integral over d cube k of this theta function. Now, theta function is 1 for all the occupied states and is 0 afterwards. So let us define a Fermi wave vector for upspin. So let me write down one more step. So I have this theta function, mu minus h bar square k square over 2m minus u n down. So I can write n up as an integral in d cube k, where k varies from 0 to k f up. This, so now let's see the volume factors. We have 2 pi cube. Sorry, the phase factors. I think I'm missing the phase factors here. Right? And how is this Kf up defined? Kf up is defined as when this quantity, if you replace Kf up, it should vanish. So Kf up is defined by mu minus h bar square. If I put Kf up here, right? So this integral we can calculate in momentum space. Let's assume it's a symmetric function in K. So what you would get is just the volume of sphere. So you'll get 4 by 3 pi kf up cube, and then you have 8 in the denominator. So you'll simply get a factor of 6. So for kf, you can do the same calculation for spin down also. So this I can write as kf cube divided by 6 pi squared. And Kf up is defined using this equation. Now, similarly, I can do the same calculation for n down. I will get Kf down cube divided by 6 pi square. Now, Kf down will be defined by similar equation. And now this will involve un up, right? So kf down, you will have down here, and so everything. So when you put down here, you will be left with un up. So it will involve n up, right? Now, from this equation, you can figure out the values of, you can write down Kf in terms of densities. So Kf up is actually 6 pi square n up cube root Kf down. Now, what this means is, in a magnetic state, if we expect n up and n down to be different, we would expect Kf up and Kf down to be different also. Any questions so far? So now we are basically left with solving this equation and this equation to find out in terms of the densities. So let me just write down these two equations. So I have mu, which should be equal to this can be written. So I will just replace this density. I will have h bar square 2m 6 pi square 2 by 3. N up 2 by 3 plus u n down Now, these two equations, let's subtract them. And then we'll have the equation we want to look at. Now, this equation we have to solve and or try to, we have to find out solution of these equations that give us values of n up and n down that are not equal. So it's not at all, it's not very straightforward because we have combinations of n up and n down here. So what we are going to do is define a quantity that we want to be non-zero. We'll define spin polarization, and let me call zeta. And this zeta is defined as n up minus n down divided by n up plus n down. And I will also define a quantity for combining this u, which was interaction strength. But now I will combine all the other factors. So I will call gamma as 2mu and I'll put a cube root factor of total density in the definition of gamma. Now you can also quickly see the reason we defined this. You can see that if I do 1 plus zeta, then you simply get 2n up over n up plus n down. That implies you can write n up as n up plus n down. Similarly, you can do 1 minus zeta, and this is 2n down. Now, using these n down and n up, put them back in this equation to the power 2 by 3 and use gamma. And now I'm just going to write down the final result. In terms of these variables, zeta and so I wrote on this one first. Seems like we have a problem. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, I think the front one. Hopefully we won't need it. So what I'm going to do is write down that equation in terms of spin polarization and the new interaction term gamma, which includes the interaction potential U. And the equation we are going to get is 1 plus zeta to the power 2 by 3 minus 1 minus zeta to the power 2 by 3 is equal to gamma zeta. So this is the equation we get if we demand self-consistency. Now, this equation is an algebraic equation, and it has three different types of solutions. The first type of solution exists if gamma, which includes the interaction strength, if gamma is less than 4 by 3. If gamma is less than 4 by 3, the only solution of this equation is the trivial solution that gives you zeta equal to 0. That means n up is equal to n down. So if interactions are weak, you would actually not get any spin polarization. The other type of solutions are if you have gamma between 4 by 3 and 2 to the power 2 by 3, then you get a solution such that this parameter zeta is between 0 and 1. And this implies partial polarization. And this phase is, you can call it a weak ferromagnet. Now, what if gamma is equal to 2 to the power 2 by 3? So you can just put in this value, 2 to the power 2 by 3, in this equation, and you'll see at this value of gamma, zeta should be equal to 1. So this is full polarization. You can call it strong ferromagnet. Any questions so far? Now, these three solutions, you can view them as in terms of density of states. And typically, these kind of plots are used. So I'm going to draw them, so you've seen it once. They are a bit strange. So in the tutorial, you calculated density of states in three dimensions for free electron gas. You found it to be square root of E. It goes as square root of E. What I'm plotting is density of state on x-axis and energy on y. And I'm making two plots. One for upspin and one for downspin. So the first case where you don't have any spin polarization, so this should look like square root of E with a shift. Now you can see this shift as if you put zeta to be zero, if n up and n down are really same, then these shifts u n up and u n down in the definition of this mean field energies, you can see that it's basically the same shift. What that means is if now I start, so I have two spectrums. This one is for spin up. This is spin up. This is the up, and this is the curve for down. Now, at t equal to zero, I have many electrons, and I would fill all of these states. And once using Pauli exclusion principle, and once I'm run out of all of the electrons, I will have the Fermi energy. So if there is no polarization, what you would get is something like this. So at Fermi energy, you have equal number of upspin and downspin electrons. If I plot the same thing for a system with partial polarization, you would see it would look like the shift are going to be different. Now, un up and un down are different. So the energy shift for n up has n down. So let's assume n up is greater. So this shift is smaller than this shift. Again, you start filling up. You start with no from vacuum. At t equals zero, you have many electrons. Fill up all the states. And here you would see that you have more upspin than downspin. And then you can do the same. So this is the regime. The first one, when your gamma is less than 4/3 is this. You don't get any polarization. So it's kind of a sudden. So if you slowly increase the interaction potential, that is like increasing gamma, you would not get any spin polarization. And then you start getting partial polarization. And then there will come a point when gamma is equal to 2^2/3. And in that stage, you would get a higher value of interaction potential. So for gamma equal to or greater than this 2^2/3, you would get full polarization. And that would mean something like this, so that you only have upspin electrons in your system. Any questions so far? So the main reason of having magnetic state is the Fock term, is that delta function, is the fact that the energy of in the mean field Hamiltonian, the energy of upspin, if you look at this energy, the mean field energy for upspin includes downspin density, and the downspin includes upspin density. Now, this can be understood because we have a short-range potential. If the potential is short-ranged, then Pauli exclusion principle guarantees that two particles with same spin cannot be in the same spatial orbital. Cannot be at the same point, cannot occupy the same spatial orbital. That means if you polarize the system, if all of them have the same spin, that means there would be no interaction energy coming from the short range interaction. So you minimize the interaction potential energy by polarizing the system, polarizing all of the electrons. And this would be the preferred state if the interaction strength is strong. If it's very large, then this way of minimizing the system energy dominates over any other energy cost, and you get a magnetic state. Any questions so far? So if not, then we are going to move to the next topic, which is superconductivity.
Quick question.
Yes.
This was all just came out of the self-consistency condition, right?
Yes. So that is, I think, one of the reasons why mean field theory, if you express the idea, it seems extremely trivial. You're replacing four product of four operators as two operators times some expectation value. But the self-consistency criteria is very stringent. Not all expectation values are going to work. It restricts the values of expectation values that the mean field Hamiltonian can take. And then the next approximation, or assumption rather, is some properties of the ground state itself. And the assumptions that we made here is that spin is conserved and momentum is conserved. So, and we find a ground state where spin is actually polarized. So this hints towards a phase transition in the system. So now this topic of superconductivity, it is in the same spirit as magnetism, but it's slightly more complicated in the sense that the interactions that we are going to include here are not typical repulsive interactions or Coulomb interactions that we have seen, but these are going to be attractive interactions for electrons. Now this few words about the problem itself. It was discovered in 1911. But basically, you take a piece of mercury, you cool it down, you measure its resistance, you see that the resistance goes down with temperature, but then around 4 Kelvin or so, it's not just going down, it drops to zero. So the system loses all its resistivity at low temperatures. There is no resistance at all. And this is how it was discovered. There were many serious attempts made in 30s and 40s to explain the theory, but the microscopic theory for superconductivity did not arrive till 1957, and this theory was presented by BCS, so Bardeen, Cooper, and Schiffer. And we'll devote some of the time in understanding this BCS theory. Just another rather fact is that you would expect, so this can be very useful for practical purposes. If you have a material that has no resistance, you'll save a lot of energy. The problem the problem is that the transition temperature, or the temperature at which the materials become superconducting, for most of the materials that we know, is rather low, in the sense that it's around 150 Kelvin or 130 Kelvin or so at atmospheric pressures. You can increase the pressure and then you can go as high as 200 Kelvin, but there is no room temperature yet. And the reason could be, well, it doesn't mean that one day we will not find a room temperature superconductor, but it may involve a different pairing mechanism than the one that we are going to discuss in BCS. So in other words, BCS theory may put some stringent criteria on the transition temperature, but you can have another way of attractive potential between electrons that could give you a higher transition temperature also. So a few things about the theory should explain that the resistivity as a function of temperature . So this is what I mean by the transition. So I'm plotting resistivity as a function of temperature, and this resistivity just drops to zero at some temperature TC. So the theory should explain this. Another thing that we know, so because the theory came only in 1957, and from 1911 onwards, there were many experiments. So the theory of superconductivity had to explain all of these experimental results. And this also provided some hints to solve the problem. So the second thing that the theory should explain was the observation that superconductor is a perfect diamagnet. So if I take a piece of superconductor, and I put this in external magnetic field, the field lines are going to go around it. This would happen only if this magnetic field is less than some critical magnetic field. If you increase the magnetic field so that it's greater than the critical field, then the superconductor will become normal diamagnet or normal, like a normal metal. The next thing is the experiments measured specific heat at constant volume. Now, this is interesting. You did a problem yesterday where you used the quantum theory of ions to calculate the specific heat. And what you found for ions is that the specific heat goes as T over TD cube, right? So TD is the Debye temperature. Now, Debye temperature for aluminum is like 400 Kelvin or so. So you can calculate the Debye temperature if you know the crystal structure. So how many ions you can put in a unit cell volume, by knowing this, you can calculate what Debye temperature is. For aluminum, this is around 400 Kelvin. So if you have 4 Kelvin, then this factor will give you 10 to the power minus 6. So at low temperatures, the contribution to specific heat coming from the ions is almost negligible. Then at low temperatures, the contribution to specific heat only comes from electrons itself. So what the specific heat means is you want to add some heat and raise the temperature of the object. At low temperature, ions contribution is almost negligible. For example, for aluminum, this would be 10 to the power minus 6 at 4 Kelvin or so. But the electrons can still be excited. So the contribution that we are going to discuss at low temperatures is the specific heat of the material due to electrons. When experimentalists measure this specific heat at constant volume, what they found is, so for normal metal, you expect the specific heat to go linearly with temperature. We'll discuss in a moment why. What they found is at TC, the specific heat looked like this. So specific heat, it goes linearly with temperature. And then at TC, there is a jump discontinuity in the specific heat. Now, when you change thermodynamic variable like temperature by small amount, and you get large changes in thermodynamic potential or specific heat, that means there is a phase transition in the system. So this provided a hint that superconductivity is probably a new phase of matter, very different from the normal metal that was known very well. Now, why is the specific heat, why is it linear with temperature? This we can understand with just Fermi function. So what I'm plotting is Fermi Dirac distribution function as a function of energy. This is the T equal to zero. At a finite temperature, this function, you can think of it like this, where these deviations are of the order kBT. Around Fermi energy. So if I want to calculate, the number of electrons in this energy window, this is going to be the density of states. Now I'm going to use G for density of states, because rho I used for resistivity. So the density of states at the Fermi energy times dE. So this is number of electrons is simply density of states at Fermi energy, which let's assume is a constant of energy or temperature. So density of states at Fermi energy times dE, which is kBT. Now, these many electrons have been excited from energy below EF to energy above EF. And the excitation energy is also of order kBT. So if I want to write down the energy, electronic energy, I can, at finite temperature T, I can write it as the electronic energy at zero temperature, plus all these electrons going from below Fermi energy to above Fermi energy. Now this calculation, we only want to get the temperature dependence, so I'm going to put a numerical factor that will take into account the fact that these shapes can have some contribution, so the final result can have, let's say, some numerical factor n. And now I'm going to have GEF kBT square. So this simply means that if you have CV, this should go linearly with temperature. If you do a more precise calculation, you'll find that this numerical factor n is, I think, pi squared over 6. But so we expect the specific heat to go linearly with temperature. But what the experiments found is a specific heat that is approximately gamma Tc A e to the power minus b Tc over T. So below Tc, the specific heat was suppressed exponentially. What that means is that below Tc, and the value of B, when they fit the numerical data, they find that B is around 1.5. So what this means is that below Tc, it's exponentially harder to excite electrons. So what we do here is at finite temperature below EF, you can easily excite, if you have a continuous dispersion relation, you can easily excite electrons. But this is becoming harder below TC. So what that means is in the electronic dispersion, you might have a gap. So it is very difficult to excite the electrons below the gap because there are no states in the gap. So the specific heat is exponentially suppressed. So this was a hint that there might be a gap in the spectrum. And then there is another thing that was measured was isotope effect. So what I'm providing is just pieces of puzzles, and we'll see that the BCS theory will explain all of these. Now, what isotope effect, what it means is they measured, they replaced the material, they replaced the material with element with its isotope. So you're changing the number of nucleons. What that means is that you're changing the type of ion or mass of the ion. What they found is that the TC, or the transition temperature at which the material becomes superconducting, goes as the mass of the isotope to the power minus alpha, where alpha was approximately half. So 1 over square root of m. Now, what this means is that the ion, the role of ions are important for superconductivity. So this provided a hint that phonons might play an important role in the theory of superconductivity. And then the last one that we discussed in the class already, we discussed that this interaction between two electrons and mediated by phonons, this type of interaction let me write down the expression that we had. And I'm writing down the operators. This is multiplied by the operator terms, which is C dagger K plus Q, C dagger K prime minus Q, CK prime CK. So last time we discussed that this interaction can be attractive whenever this term is smaller than this term. So that's a general criteria. Whenever this term is negative, you have attractive interaction between electrons mediated by phonons. We discussed a special case where we took two electrons close to the Fermi C. And we discussed that in this particular case, we know for sure that interactions between two electrons can be attractive. Any questions? Yes.
Can you repeat the explanation of number four, about the CV going exponentially?
So the specific heat we expect in normal metal, which has a continuum dispersion, we expect it to go linearly with temperature. So you can choose temperature, say it's very small. You can still excite an electron very easily because there are continuum of states. Now, when you are below T is less than TC, that means I can move it up. So what that means is when I'm below TC, it is exponentially harder to excite electrons. So you can add heat, but the system would not raise its temperature. It's exponentially harder to do this. Because electrons, so it suggests that electrons don't have anywhere to go because it's exponentially harder for them. So that means in the electronic spectrum, we might have a gap. Now, this term, the reason we discussed that at Fermi energy, for sure, this is going to be attractive, is because that's where we will start the problem. So what we are going to do is what is called the Cooper problem. Which is to say that let's ignore, now this interaction, we know it can be attractive, but it is still fairly complicated. It depends on K and Q and so on. So let's simplify the problem a lot. Let's assume that we are going to ignore all the details of the attractive interaction between the electrons. And we are only going to retain the fact that it is attractive. And we are going to assume that we have a filled Fermi C. So we have a filled Fermi C. Let's say this is Fermi momentum Kf. This Fermi C is non-interacting. It does not interact. So this is, we obtain this Fermi C from just the single particle energies, just the kinetic energies. Now, in the background of this Fermi C, we are going to assume two electrons which are very close to the Fermi C in energy. Now, we know that if they are very close to the Fermi energy, the interaction between them is attractive, mediated by phonons. So next, what we want to look at is bound state. Can such a system give rise to a bound state of two electrons? So this calculation of bound state of two particle system, I think a similar calculation you can do for three particles, you can find bound state of quarks. And so this calculation is in the same spirit. The key difference here, though, is the presence of the Fermi C. So we can, any questions so far? So next I'm going to write down a general wave function of two particles. Because, so what we have is two electrons in the presence of Fermi C, and the Fermi C is non-interacting. These two electrons are not interacting with any electrons in the Fermi C. They're only interacting with each other. So the wave function for two electron system, we discussed in the first lecture that we can write this, we can expand it in a complete basis set. What that means is I can write this as sum over K1, K2, some Fourier coefficients K1, K2. I hope I'm using the same notation. If there is any confusion, just ask. And then I'm going to write down the Slater determinant or permanent. So we have psi K1, R1, psi K2, R2, minus psi K1, R2, and psi K2, R1. Now this is, let me put plus or minus here. Plus gives us a wave function for two particles that is symmetric under exchange. Minus gives us a wave function that is anti-symmetric under exchange. And this is a very general wave function. This K1 and K2 are summed over all possible values. So we take a complete basis of two particle Hilbert space, and we can expand this wave function in this complete basis. Now, one of the properties that we discuss for fermions is that they are anti-symmetric under exchange. What that means is if you exchange two fermions in the wave function, in the two-particle wave function, if you exchange the location of two fermions, you should get a minus sign. What that means is also another thing that we know or we expect is we expect to form a bound state of two electrons. So we expect the wave function of these two particles to have a finite value when R1 and R2 are very close to each other. So now there is a complication from what we discussed in the first week, that if we discussed that if you have, say, I'm replacing R1 minus R2 by R, so if you take, if you exchange the two, if you consider minus R for fermions, you should get minus psi R. This implied that when R goes to zero, psi of R goes to zero. Right? So this criteria actually goes against the idea of having bound state at all. So that means if you try to form a bound state of two electrons, the wave function, the amplitude would be very small. There is a way around this, which means we choose this psi to be symmetric. Symmetric. If psi is symmetric, then this no longer holds, and I can expect the wave function to be finite when R1 and R2 are close by. But this wave function is still a wave function for two fermions. So I should expect a sign change. Where can that sign change come from? So that sign change we can include in the spin part of the wave function. So in this calculation in the first week, we did not have the spin part of the fermions. So the total wave function, let me write psi total. This we can write as psi R1 minus R2. And now I'm going to write the spin part of the wave function. Now both electrons have spin half. And I'm going to choose the spin part of the wave function as up down minus down up divided by square root of 2. Now this psi is assumed to be symmetric. When we do the exchange, so this, the first thing written here is the first particle and this is the second particle. In this state, if you exchange 1 and 2, you get down up minus up down, which can be written as minus up down minus down up. So you do get a minus sign from exchange just from the spin part. So if I impose this criteria that the bound state must be a spin singlet, so this is called spin singlet state. If it must be spin singlet, then I can get a finite wave function for this when R1 is very close to R2. Any questions so far? So now I have this general form for the two particle wave function. I know it represents two fermions. It obeys all the exchange, it obeys the exchange symmetry we expect for fermions. And next, our task is going to simplify the problem further. And I'm going to prove that I'm going to use the same discussion that was presented by Cooper, that you can form a bound state of two electrons. Now, because psi, we want it to be symmetric, we'll take the plus sign here. Right? Now, what we are going to do is we are going to change coordinates. So we are going, let's go to center of mass and relative coordinate. Now, right now we have R1 and R2. We can go to center of mass coordinate and the relative coordinate. What we are going to do is we are going to minimize the energy in the center of mass coordinate. What does that mean? Now, we know that the interaction potential only depends on the relative coordinate. So when you write the Hamiltonian in center of mass and relative coordinates, the only contribution you will have for the center of mass coordinate will be the kinetic energy. If I choose the center of mass momentum to be zero, I can minimize the energy in the center of mass coordinate. Now, what does center of mass momentum zero means? It means that the two electrons must have equal and opposite momentum, right? So next, in this expression, I'm going to make K1, I'm going to call it K, and K2, I'm going to call it minus K. And I'm going to use momentum eigenstates, so I'm going to use plane waves for these wave functions, the single particle ones. So the sum over K1, K2 will become only a single sum over K. And I will have alpha K, say minus K. And then I will have e to the power I K R1 minus R2. Now plus sign e to the power minus I K R1 minus R2. So if you're worried about for the determinants and permanents, we had this square root of n factorial and so on, that can all be absorbed in the normalization of the wave function. So we're not going to worry about those factors. So here what I've done is I have e to the power I K dot R1 here, IK1 R1, IK2 R2, K2 is minus K1, K1 is K, so I just get this expression. And the other term, the reverse, you can see, will give you the same with a minus sign. So this can be written as sum over K, alpha K minus K, times 2 cosine K, dot R1 minus R2. Any questions so far? So this is the wave function that we are going to use. So now we started with the sum over a complete basis involving two sums, because we had a two-particle Hilbert space. We imposed, because what we are interested in is to find the ground state of the system. And what we are interested in showing is that the system can actually lower its energy by forming a bound state. So what we are really interested in is the lowest possible energy. So we went to the center of mass and relative coordinate. We minimized the energy in the center of mass coordinate. So we have to now solve Schrödinger equation only for relative coordinate and look for solutions that give us energy values which are lower than what the energies would be if the two electrons are not bound. So we are going to do the detailed calculation to Monday. What we can expect, now this is filled Fermi C. There is absolutely no state below EF available. So the state of the ground state of these two systems should have energy greater than 2 times Fermi energy. Is that that makes sense? All energies below the Fermi energy are occupied. So the only values of energy that these two electrons, if they were single particles, they can take, or they were not bound, has to make the total energy of the system to be 2 times the Fermi energy plus something. It has to be greater than the 2 EF. What we will find is that the bound state of these two electrons is going to result in the total energy of 2 electrons plus a filled Fermi C to be 2 times Fermi energy minus something. And this signifies that there is an instability in the system. If the electrons can lower system's energy by just forming pairs, and there is a finite binding energy, then there is an instability, and the electrons on the Fermi surface, they're going to just lower their free energy by forming pairs. Once you have pairs, these are no longer fermions. You have 2 spin-half electrons. So the total spin now is 1 or 0. So it's an integer spin, and you no longer have Pauli's exclusion principle. So once you form pairs, the system can minimize its energy by forming a Bose-Einstein condensate of Cooper pairs, which are pairs of 2 electrons. Any questions? So let's start on Monday. You will have a problem on superconductivity in the homework. You can wait till Monday or Tuesday to start that one.